This is an Alexandrian Media original podcast.
Happy Valentine's Day / Singles Awareness Day. Whether you're listening to this episode on February 14th or 15th or whenever, I thought it would be the perfect time for another holiday bonus episode. This will be one of three holiday bonus episodes this year, which will also include a Halloween bonus and a Christmas bonus. No matter if you're single or in a relationship, we all need a bit of love in our lives right now, so enjoy today's episode on the many musical adaptations of Romeo and Juliet. What image comes to mind when I say the term star-crossed? Does the image of two lovers materialize in your mind's eye, destined to fall in love with each other despite all odds against them? It's quite possible that it immediately made you think of Shakespeare's legendary Romeo and Juliet, a story of two lovers who, against the will of their families, fall in love and attempt to run away together, only ending in utter tragedy. While of course the topic today is Romeo and Juliet, they're not the only characters of our literary past that have befallen the same fate. With them, we have Pelléas and Mélisande, Anna and Vronsky, Gatsby and Daisy, or Catherine and Heathcliff. But what exactly are star-crossed lovers? Merriam-Webster defines the term star-crossed as not favored by the stars. It can also mean that something is unlucky, and in the case of Romeo and Juliet, everything about them, as written down by Shakespeare, reeks of bad luck from the moment their eyes meet from across the room. At the moment the play was written and performed for the first time, the two were just an unlucky pair, betrothed to people they no longer saw kindly, and set on a path that would get them both killed. However, what makes this pair truly star-crossed is that since that premiere, the pair have been forced to relive their miserable fates over and over again for the rest of eternity. And they have relived those lives hundreds, if not by now thousands of times on stages, movies, concert halls, opera houses, ballet stages, and so many other places where their story has inspired new art. Today, I'd like to explore just a few of those reincarnations. Of course, the original play has been placed in the spotlight an innumerable amount of times, but that play has been the inspiration for many musical works, especially within the 19th and early 20th centuries. There are 24 known operas based on the play, and an unknowable amount of symphonic works and incidental music arrangements. In more recent times, Romeo and Juliet has also inspired songs within popular music, including songs by The Supremes, Bruce Springsteen, Taylor Swift, and Dire Straits. Even Leonard Bernstein and Stephen Sondheim adapted the play for their own purposes to fashion the sensational West Side Story. There are far too many for me to cover in one episode of this podcast, so today I'd like to cover at least five of history's most famous adaptations of this tragic tale. Vincenzo Bellini's opera I Capuletti e I Montecchi, Hector Berlioz's Symphonie Dramatique Romeo et Juliette, Charles Gounod's opera Romeo et Juliette, Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture, and Sergei Prokofiev's ballet, Romeo and Juliet. This is the Composer Chronicles, a podcast that recounts the stories of composers past and present through the music they write. I'm Stephen Trigar, and this is episode number 38, Star-Crossed, the musical reincarnations of Romeo and Juliet. After the unsuccessful premiere of his opera Zaira, Vincenzo Bellini was left without a contract and was forced to return to Milan. He did have one glimmer of hope, though. The composer Giovanni Pacini signed a contract for two operas, one in Turin and the other in Milan, thanks to the success with the opera Il Talismano. But the Teatro La Fenice impresario Alessandro Lanardi was skeptical that he could pull this off, and he included a proviso that if Pacini was unable to fulfill one of the two operas, Bellini would take on the unfinished project. Since I am here talking about this opera today, it's clear that Pacini was unable to fulfill his contract, and Bellini was easily persuaded into writing an opera based on Romeo and Juliet for the 1830 Carnival season at the Teatro La Fenice in Venice. Carnival, if you can remember from episodes 23 and 37, is a festive season just before Lent. Various countries and cultures have their own versions of Carnival, but in the end, picture the Venetian Carnival like our own Mardi Gras. By the time he was approached with a task, Bellini was already in Venice overseeing rehearsals of his earlier opera, Il Pirata. With a libretto already compiled by the Italian poet and scholar Felice Romani, this composition was the perfect opportunity for Bellini to regain favor with the public as a composer, despite only having a month and a half to compose the work. Of course, Bellini worked as quickly as he could, reusing a great deal of music from his recently failed opera, Zaira. The premiere of I Capuletti e I Montecchi on March 11, 1830 was an undeniable success. It was so successful, in fact, that his reputation was repaired and he had gained international fame. His music was being performed in theaters all around the world, and the opera was being performed regularly all across Europe. I don't want to get too much deeper into the history of this piece, but what I do want to say is that this adaptation of Romeo and Juliet is not quite the Romeo and Juliet that you remember. The opera is appropriately titled I Capuletti e Montecchi because the opera is more centered around the Capulets and Montagues rather than Romeo and Juliet themselves. Picture this. Romani's libretto shoved the plot of Shakespeare's play into a tumbler, poured in some political rivalry, and shook it all up. The Capulets and the Montagues were not rival families. They were rival political factions, and Romeo and Juliet were already in love before the whole thing started. Tybalt, originally her cousin in Shakespeare's play, replaces Paris as her betrothed, and Friar Lawrence? Well, he's not Friar Lawrence anymore. He's essentially Juliet's nurse. Romeo is the leader of the Montecchi faction, and instead of killing Tybalt in Mercutio's honor, Romeo accidentally kills Juliet's brother prior to beginning the opera. Not to worry, the tragedy of the two dying together in the Capulet tomb remains true, but instead of Romeo taking the poison and dying before Juliet wakes up, where she then kills herself with a dagger, in Bellini's opera, Romeo takes the poison, and Juliet wakes up before he's dead. The two converse, and when Juliet says they should run away together, Romeo says that he's unable to, as he has already drank the poison. And then he dies. Then Juliet dies, unable to live without him. While we're on the topic of highly altered plots of the play, Berlioz, with a French libretto by Emile Deschamps, also made some significant changes to the story to fit his own needs. Berlioz was a great admirer of Shakespeare's work, a subject that comes up quite frequently in many of his pieces. However, this work was truly inspired by a performance of the play he witnessed in 1827 at Paris's Odeon Theatre, which included his beloved Harriet Smithson. He would go on to write that at times he was so taken by the beauty of the passionate poetry that he could scarcely breathe, and like there was an iron hand gripping his heart. It was this performance and his experience at that event that the symphony is based on, but the composition wouldn't take place until much later, when the virtuoso violinist Niccolo Paganini gifted Berlioz 20,000 francs after hearing a performance of Berlioz's earlier symphony, Harold in Italy, a symphony that makes use of a solo viola part throughout the work. In Berlioz's and Duchamp's version, Juliet wakes up from her death-like slumber just before Romeo dies, much like Bellini's opera had done. Similar to Bellini, they also removed the role of the nurse, but instead of replacing the nurse with a different character, they left out the part entirely. The two also expanded upon the reconciliation of the two families, which in the play is only briefly mentioned. This makes for a very grand choral finale. Berlioz thought very highly of his work on this symphony. In his memoirs, he would state that of all the music he wrote, his favorite was the music from the love scene of this symphony. In general, he regarded this work as one of his greatest, and his participation in the rehearsals of the premiere are evident of that belief. He truly pioneered the practice of sectional rehearsals, a common practice today where the orchestra is split up into groups to rehearse more challenging sections of the music and to maximize the time of everyone in the orchestra. Romeo and Juliet received only 2 full orchestra rehearsals before its premiere at the Paris Conservatoire on November 24, 1839. This piece had been the talk of the town for weeks leading up to the premiere, and that first performance, along with the 2 performances that followed on December 1st and 15th, filled the hall to capacity. To truly hammer in the significance of this work on the musical world, one of the notable audience members was none other than Richard Wagner, who admitted that this symphony would be an important influence on his opera, Tristan und Isolde. Let's take a listen to an excerpt from the love scene so you can get a taste of this monolithic achievement. While Bellini's and Berlioz's adaptations of Romeo and Juliet have their places within history, neither have been able to achieve the same success that Charles Gounod's opera Romeo and Juliet has had. To this day, performances of the opera are regularly staged, and Juliet's waltz aria Je veux vivre is regularly performed separately in recitals and concerts. While today it is seen as a great success, it certainly had its fair share of difficulties when being prepared to stage. The popularity of his opera Faust at the Théâtre Lyrique, being performed over 300 times in only 9 years there, led them to commission another opera from Gounod. Once the opera was completed, they had major setbacks in casting the lead tenor, and Gounod recomposed the last act twice to make it easier. Once it made it to the public, all the stress had paid off because it was heralded as a major success for Gounod. Romeo and Juliet had a similar success to Faust, receiving 391 performances in 14 years at the Opéra Comique. On November 28, 1888, the opera was transferred from the Opéra Comique's repertoire to the Paris Opéra's, a significant move, as the Paris Opéra's repertoire was reserved only for the best and most serious of operas. Gounod's opera, with the libretto by Jules Barbier and Michel Carré, sticks much closer to Shakespeare's original plan than the previous 2 pieces. The only major difference, which is something that both Bellini and Berlioz had done, was that Juliet awakens in time for her and Romeo to converse one final time while the poison sets in. Once Romeo dies of the poison, Juliet stabs herself with the famous dagger. We'll take a look at the last 2 pieces right after the break. would a world without music be like? I certainly don't want to know. This podcast would not exist. Luckily, we don't have to find out what that world is like. I do a lot of listening in a day between all of my favorite music and podcasts, and it's not just for entertainment. I'm constantly doing research for this podcast and switching back and forth between apps to listen to a podcast episode and then a piece of music can get tiresome if I'm trying to quickly switch back and forth. From an episode of Hey Riddle Riddle to Stravinsky's The Firebird Ballet Suite and then to Lady Gaga's latest album, I can listen to them all on Amazon Music whenever and wherever I want. I start listening when I get into my car, and then when I get home, I switch over to my Alexa while I cook dinner for me and my fiance. Listeners of this podcast can join me in listening to all of the best music and greatest podcasts on Amazon Music Unlimited right now when you sign up today at getamazonmusic.com/thecomposerchronicles and get your first 30 days for free. You can get unlimited access to any song and do all of that listening without any ads. So again, go to getamazonmusic.com/thecomposerchronicles and start listening on Amazon Music Unlimited today.
Hi, my name is Kaylin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Tea Time Thoughts. Do you ever wish you could learn more about history, books, music, art, and culture, but you just don't know where to start? I totally feel your pain. Learning about all these things can be so overwhelming. Well, I want to change all of that for you. In my podcast, Tea Time Thoughts, I'll show you just how fun it all can be. In the time it takes to have a cup of tea, I'm going to teach you everything from the French Revolution to the Black Plague, Mozart to Broadway musicals, Da Vinci to Robert Frost, ancient Egypt to Queen Elizabeth II, and more. You can stream Tea Time Thoughts wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. So what are you waiting for? Put the kettle on and listen to Tea Time Thoughts today.
Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture is probably one of the most famous pieces of music, whether you know it or not. Its lush, romantic love theme has become embedded into our modern culture, regularly representing budding love on movies, television shows, and other forms of media, appearing in Wayne's World, Animaniacs, A Christmas Story, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, SpongeBob SquarePants, and The Three Musketeers. It even made its way into the original The Sims video game, when two Sims successfully performed the kiss interaction. Let's listen to it, and you'll know exactly what I mean. Aside from Romeo and Juliet, Tchaikovsky created some of the most recognizable pieces of music of all time, such as Most of the Nutcracker, excerpts from Swan Lake and Sleeping Beauty, and even parts of the 1812 Overture. His success came at an emotional price, and that's especially true when it comes to Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture. Fellow Russian composer Midi Balakriev was the dedicatee of Tchaikovsky's symphonic poem Fatum, which prompted Balakriev to write Tchaikovsky a letter with some constructive criticism about the work. Tchaikovsky was too self-critical and took Balakriev's comments as harsher criticism than was intended. But their relationship remained strong enough for Balakriev to suggest that Tchaikovsky take up writing a concert overture based on Romeo and Juliet. At first, Tchaikovsky ignored the suggestion. He was busy with writing his opera Undine, an opera that would eventually be destroyed. When Balakriev pushed a little further, Tchaikovsky would tell him that he was just too tired to take up such a project. But Balakriev was not taking no for an answer. He even provided his own King Lear overture as a model for Romeo and Juliet. Tchaikovsky caved in and agreed to write the work, reducing the plot to one central conflict and containing musical depictions of the characters within a binary sonata form. The Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture has three completed versions. The initial premiere on March 16, 1870 was stunted by a court case surrounding the premiere's conductor Nikolai Rubinstein and a young female student. The ruling was against Rubinstein, and when he appeared on the podium for this concert, a huge demonstration ensued. After the concert was over, nobody said anything about the performance, which led Tchaikovsky to believe this piece was a failure. So, he decided to take Balakriev's criticism and rework the piece. Rubinstein had become very impressed by Tchaikovsky, particularly in relation to Romeo and Juliet, and so Rubinstein urged Tchaikovsky to publish the work. Balakriev became upset that Rubinstein was pushing him to publish the work because it had not been revised to its greatest potential yet. But the work was published anyway and premiered in St. Petersburg on February 17, 1872. 10 years later, Tchaikovsky rewrote the ending and subtitled it Overture Fantasia. This is the version that is most performed today, although the first two versions are occasionally performed for historical curiosity. Last, but not least on this lineup, is Sergei Prokofiev's ballet. Of the pieces we've discussed so far, this is the first time that the story ends with both Romeo and Juliet living happily ever after. This had been Prokofiev's original intent with the ballet, to step away from the bombardment of negativity. However, it provoked controversy among Soviet cultural officials. Problems with the Bolshoi staff halted production of the ballet indefinitely, and together with general fear about how the musical and theatrical community would react to this altered ending, was cause enough for the ballet to essentially fail before it even began. Prokofiev was stubborn. He didn't want to change the ending. The conductor Yuri Feyer would beg him to change the ending to the more traditional one. Feyer would eventually conduct the first performance of the ballet at the Bolshoi Theater, but before then, the ballet would remain unperformed for a few years. Suites of the ballet music were heard in Moscow and throughout the United States, and eventually a stage production would be put on at the Mayhem Theater in Brno, in what is now the Czech Republic, on December 30th, 1938. This production was essentially just a single-act production, with music compiled from the first two suites. Unfortunately, because of being restricted from leaving the Soviet Union, Prokofiev was unable to attend this premiere. Today, Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet is one of the most regularly performed ballets, using its full score. The three suites that Prokofiev compiled from the full score are each performed frequently, with occasional performances of various numbers from each of the suites to make an entirely unique performance. Prokofiev would even go on to reduce selected music from the ballet to form a suite of 10 pieces for piano. Needless to say, Prokofiev certainly tried to make sure his music for this tragic tale would be performed anywhere. Regardless of what form they have taken, Romeo and Juliet will continue to live on for generations to come. These pieces of music, and all art that attempt to encapsulate their story, continue to propel the story throughout time, forcing them to relive their tragic end again and again. The true definition of star-crossed. This episode was written and researched by me, Stephen Trigar, with theme music written by Daryl Banner. All music and sources used for this episode can be found in the show notes or by going to alexandrianmedia.org/thecomposerchronicles. If you've enjoyed this episode, leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, or wherever you can submit ratings and reviews. If you really like the show, become a member on my Patreon page. For only $1.50 per month, members get early access to ad-free versions of every episode, plus a bonus podcast titled Unscripted. Memberships are a huge support, so consider becoming a member. If you'd like to stay up to date on all news related to the Composer Chronicles, follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Chron Podcast on all platforms. This Wednesday, join me as I chat with composer Barnaby Martin, whose career as a composer has led him to become a video essayist. His YouTube channel, Listening In, is a brilliant channel designed to give you a behind-the-scenes look at music and the worlds it inspires. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next time.
Alexandrian Media, art and culture for the modern era.